shall we dive into the kind of part two here? Is that okay with you guys?
Yeah, I've got it recording, and the, you know, it sounds so interesting what you're talking about today.
Thank you both for your positive feedback from last Tuesday as well as Friday. I really appreciate the conversation. I've now completed with Colleen the second chapter of this book. It's moving along well. It's wonderful when you've been living material and working the material in presentations and so on for a couple of years, because the actual writing, I literally sit down and just write. I don't have to, you know, at this point it's kind of like it's in my bone marrow, the material. So there'll be editing and all of that, but it feels really good. It reminds me and Heidi, you worked closely with John in writing his book. John can sit down, if you pull the string on the side of his neck, like a doll, John could talk for days, you know, about this material. He knows it inside out, and I don't pretend to be as conversant as John is about this, but there's a sense of that for me in the writing, and our conversations really help stimulate it in terms of kind of bringing it into dialogue in a way that is really a luxury for me. So really want to thank both of you particularly for your support and your interaction. So I'll tell you what I'm thinking, and Heidi, I want to run this by you. I think we've kind of implied this, but my wish today would be to talk today about what Gary Nixon called stage one recovery, but talk about it in the context of a couple. And that can be generalized to a family. And by couple, I'm going to be talking about kind of a couple that's in a committed relationship. It could also be a father and a son, a mother and a daughter, all kinds of different ways of looking at the relationship. But just for simplicity's sake, I use it in terms of a couple that's in a long-term relationship. So today would be stage one recovery. And my thought, Heidi, for next Tuesday, in fact, I made sure last night with Colleen that she would be available, would be next Tuesday morning to bring Colleen on the show, so to speak, and really draw on her expertise in addressing what Nixon calls stage two recovery, again, from the perspective of working with relationships.
That sounds wonderful. And okay. I know everyone was great with that, all the other teams.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. Thanks for checking on that. I want to make sure. How's that sound to you, Victoria? Victoria?
Huh. I'm showing that she's still right here.
Okay, maybe her sound is off. I'm going to take that as a thumbs up.
Yeah, I would.
Yeah. Why don't we
go ahead? Can you hear me now?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, great.
Somehow it flipped on to mute. I didn't even do that. But anyway, okay, thanks.
I'll tell you what happens to me sometimes, Victoria. Maybe, Heidi, you have this experience. My cell phone is resting on my ear right now, and not infrequently I'll bump my ear on the phone and it will hit right where mute is. And I go, how'd that happen?
That must have been what happened. Yes.
Really. That's the disadvantage of these kind of touch phones, is that if you touch them with your ear, it can do all kinds of havoc. So, does that idea sound okay as a sequencing for you, as well, Victoria? That today we would address.
I think it sounds great, Bob. I said I would love to hear Colleen's perspective. So I think
Thank you. That's great. Thank you. I appreciate your openness. Colleen is very literate herself in integral theory as well as integral recovery. She's not a formal part of the community. I'll tell you, as a preface to next week, her real career investment is being an active part of the what she calls the EFT community. That's the emotionally focused therapy community that we mentioned last week, with Sue Johnson as being the founder or premier researcher. There's a whole cadre of people doing research now in EFT across the world, basically. Colleen is really invested in that community. In fact, she went up to the Los Angeles chapter, had a meeting last week, and they have dozens of therapists up in LA that have trained in this, and they met, and then she's also, she's actually in the administration of the Orange County chapter. So she's very invested in that community, but particularly, Heidi, you might be interested in this too, particularly interested, as we've talked about, of bringing not only a focus that's heretofore not been there in the EFT community, namely on recovery, but even more specifically, bringing an integral sensibility to EFT. So none of that's really been done, and if it's being done, it's being done by people that we've yet to make contact with. But Colin's fairly conversant with the various listservs and has put this material out there, and people are receptive to it in the emotionally focused therapy community, but it's new. It's new to them. So that's kind of her reference community, and Heidi and I and Victoria are in the among other things, the integral community. So our wish is to form a wedding over time, whether it be a cross conversation. Right. I think it will serve the integral community too to have more literacy in what's going on in the EFT community, because it really is, it's the one approach to marriage and family therapy that's actually approved by the American Psychological Association, which means it's reimbursable by insurance companies as a evidence-based practice. You know, at this point, any practice that's going to be reimbursed has to be evidence-based in terms of research, and EFT is really coming out of, like we talked about last week, tons and tons of research, so kind of the cutting edge at this point. So anyway, it'll be great to have her next week, and I'm looking forward to her meeting all of you. That's a selfish wish, but I want her to meet you guys too. So.
Bob, may I ask a question? I have worked with EFT, but it was called Emotional Freedom Technique, and is that the same thing?
No, I'm glad you mentioned that to me. I know just enough about Emotional Freedom Technique. Some people have called Colleen and have talked about, does she do tapping? And there are other techniques, I'm sure, and I'm not familiar with the specifics, and you probably have training in it. They're not the same, and I tell her from time to time, it's probably important just to say the entire phrase, because people, here in Southern California, for sure, people will mistake that for being a technique that is more of an alternative approach that has had a lot of, I guess, effect with trauma. You can tell me more about that.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Well, it's used across the board, but that's when I began exploring it, when I'd had significant stressors in my life, and it was extremely helpful. So this isn't the tapping work that she's doing.
No,
this is something different.
It's an unfortunate collision of what do they call them?
Acronyms.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking for that term. Thank you, guys. I kept thinking of anagram, and I knew that wasn't right. And so just to clarify, it's coming from a different tradition for sure.
Would you give what hers is again? The acronym is EFT, but what does it stand for?
Emotionally focused therapy.
I get it. What you were talking about last time.
Yeah. So yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm glad that you asked for clarification. If you were to look up emotionally focused therapy and add to Johnson, like in a Google search, you'll come up with a raft of brief articles kind of summarizing it. And Colleen will be speaking into that perspective next week, specifically working with couples in stage two. So we'll flesh that out more, and maybe over time we can actually go more in depth. This is very much, I was sharing with Colleen last night, this feels like kind of like the Reader's Digest version of this material. But truthfully, our mm-hmm. book is going to be about all that we're talking about, and we'll go into a whole lot more depth, that's for sure. But it feels good to at least introduce it to the conversation here at Integral Recovery Institute. So, let's dive in
now. So that was good timing to talk about other things for so long. Hi, Lisa.
Ooh.
Hey,
oh, Lisa.
Heidi, thank you for sending me the note. I was planning on 1 o'clock. So total brain seizure, sorry.
Yeah, so glad you're here, Lisa.
Yeah.
Lisa, we have Heidi and Victoria and Bob here, and so welcome. I just gave a kind of an introduction, and then we're going to dive in, Lisa, just real briefly. Last week we introduced, on Tuesday, we introduced a vignette, hypothetical vignette, and kind of unpacked it in and around Wilbur's lower left-hand quadrant, looking at the relational dimension, specifically of recovery, and looked at some of the issues that come to the fore in the early stages of recovery, and I'm going to amplify that more today by going more in detail with some of the looking at stage one recovery from Gary Nixon's writings, looking at the earliest stage of recovery and talking about that in terms of post-acute withdrawal syndrome, and most importantly, how that looks from the perspective of any relationship. And for simplicity's sake, we'll be focusing on a couple's relationship, romantic, committed couple, let's say. And you can substitute any relationship here, honestly, within the family, any significant relationship. So that's really shorthand for we're looking at the lower left-hand quadrant. And then real quickly, Lisa, we talked that next Tuesday morning, my partner Colleen will be joining me, and we'll be looking at stage two further down the road and how you really begin to work on repairing ruptures in the relationship for the couple, working from a perspective that is both integrally informed and rooted in research, contemporary research on marriage and family therapy. So that's what we'll be doing next week. So for today, we're looking at stage one recovery. And just for shorthand on this, Nixon refers to this stage as getting sober. This is the stage of getting sober. And I'm going to talk more about the time frame, broadly in just a moment. But what Colleen and I also added to this is not only getting sober for the addicted individual in recovery, but also addressing burnout, particularly for the, we're going to assume, non-addicted spouse who is also going to be involved in the recovery process. And so it's kind of a twofold focus in this early, this earliest stage of stage one. What happens is, and we all have this experience either firsthand or secondhand, that once the addict enters into their treatment, the significant other is most typically burnt out and themselves in need of supportive assistance. And we'll talk more about this, but most often this looks like the addicted individual in recovery joining a 12-step group like AA or NA, and the partner going into something like Al-Anon. And I'm going to talk about that in a few minutes in regards to strengths there as well as possible liabilities. In terms of burnout, that's the colloquial term for what the stress researcher Hans Selye, a Canadian psychologist, referred to as general adaptation syndrome. And I won't have a chance to go deeply into the biology of it, but basically what you have with that is a sustained high level of stress hormones, cortisol and adrenaline, which really breaks down the physical body. And all of us have experienced that in various forms. When we're so stressed out, we start falling ill and so on. But just as significantly is that there's an erosion of psychological resilience and ability to cope. And again, I think all of us have had our own experiences of burnout. So there really is a very kind of objectifiable physiology to burnout. In addition to it being a popular term, it actually is a medical term as well. And anybody that's familiar with the addiction process, I am firsthand, and some of us are firsthand, and some of us are secondhand, have borne witness to the profound toll that it takes on all of our relationships. The significance of this, and we'll be writing about this in the book, is that, and I mentioned this in our conversation last week, is that if the addict is serious about their recovery, that the number one trigger for relapse, unfortunately, is stress. We've just been talking about stress. That's the number one trigger for relapse, and the number one stressor. If it's the number one trigger for relapse of stress, the number one stress is our relationship stress. And so when you have a relationship that is rife with disappointment and, untold loss, betrayals of trust, deceit, it's gonna inflame the relationship in a way that unfortunately, I had this experience working in rehabs here in Southern California, and all of you have your own experiences to reference as well. And it'd be interesting just to talk about it for a moment, where we'd have people that would leave the rehab really clean and sober and well on their way, sometimes after 30 days, sometimes after 60 or 90 days. And we would have what they call the family day, where the family would come in and everybody would meet and be polite and nicey-nice. But the person would graduate from the rehab, go home to a situation where they were basically counseled to work on their issues in the program, maybe get a counselor, but most often the emphasis was on getting involved in AA and Al-Anon, and things would go off the rails. And sure as shooting, a month or two or three later, that person would be back in the rehab having relapsed. And so that's the kind of the pragmatic issue that we're trying to address here is what goes wrong in and around relationships when people are in this earliest stage, because we're just talking about stage one right now, stage one recovery. And I want to talk about that in a moment in terms of post-acute withdrawal syndrome and what's going on in the brain. But I want to pause for just a second and check in to see, do you all have thoughts, memories, reactions to how this has gone in your life or in the lives of others that you've known that were sincere about their recovery, but their significant family relationships were so highly stressed that it was unbearable. And for many of them, unfortunately, they relapsed.
Well, this is Victoria, and I certainly do have my experience with that. I'll just tell it briefly. I had been working at a treatment center and discovered that the alcoholism existed in my family, did an intervention with my then husband. He went into treatment and complied. Everything was going beautifully, and I don't remember. This was 20-some years ago,
yes,
30
sure,
maybe.
Sure.
But his recovery lasted all of about 4 or 5 days, and then he just started drinking again.
Yeah.
And so that what you're describing is still very present for me. It was extremely, extremely difficult. So he, I thought, was committed to recovery, but obviously couldn't and didn't sustain it.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that, Victoria, and I'm sorry for the suffering of that. It's just awful, and you know firsthand what it's like to really have some cautious hopes in place. Beyond that, and to just experience such bitter disappointment and a reversal like that. Ugh, it's just really, really
and part painful. Of a strong memory for me, too, is that I was absolutely exhausted and burned out and needed help from other people, but I don't remember whether I felt, it wasn't so much ashamed, I just didn't know how to let anybody else know that I needed help and support. So I was just trying to pull it all together with two small children and what was going on there. And certainly in maturity, I would have done it quite differently. But that was one of the really difficult parts of it.
The isolation. I really appreciate you mentioning that. And a few minutes later in our conversation today, I want to address what might be done for the spouse or the partner who's left holding the bag, basically. And what you're mentioning in terms of isolation is so often the case. And I want to talk about it in terms of what coaches and or therapists might do to facilitate more of a sense of connection. And providing more of a roadmap, because you left your own devices, you're highly stressed out, you've got two young children, and there's plenty of social stigma out there to also affect reaching out. And how the heck are you supposed to know to do that? It's not like we learned this stuff in school. And as in your case, so many people drop by the wayside very early on. The addict relapses, the couple ends up experiencing yet another defeat, and it's just really awful. So we're really talking about trying to break that cycle, and it's difficult at best, but at least to have some kind of roadmap would be helpful. Thank you, Victoria. Heidi, Lisa, any comments or reflections from either one of you?
Well, I know I've experienced comments like, why should I go seek any, be involved in your recovery or seek, quote-unquote, help when I'm not the one that has the problem.
Yeah.
And Mm-hmm. What stands out to me with that is that it's seen as a problem, whereas if I had cancer, it wouldn't be seen as a problem, and nobody would say that I came out of remission because I wasn't committed. Like, I don't know an addict on the planet that wants to continue to be addicted. What I heard on the edge of what you were saying was, I just hope the focus starts to move to brain health and away from... the other, because it's more rational, and it's also a more accurate, what I'm seeing, a more accurate portrayal about why relapse happens. It's not because they're not committed. They may not be committed, or they may be committed, but if they get the right brain health treatment, we're seeing more effects. I was shocked the other day watching Dr. Phil. I was pleased and shocked. Pleased that he's talking dual diagnosis treatment centers now. And shocked when I hear things like, yes, you have an addiction, but we're sending you to a dual diagnosis treatment center so they can also address your psychological issues, as if those are two separate things.
Very interesting.
And we wonder why people don't stay sober. I went to treatment twice. I paid $30,000. I saw a therapist one day a week. It was a joke. And never did I get to, and I knew it. I knew I wasn't getting to the bottom of it. I just wanted to lay around and do, go to meetings and not do the difficult work.
No, I hear you. I hear you loud and clear.
So, I love this conversation. And what I'm learning about neuroplasticity and the brain and why relapse happens a lot of times, about what's going on in the brain with certain kinds of drugs and certain kinds of people, I think that conversation, if that doesn't get integrated into the addiction thing, as well as the psychological piece getting integrated as one thing, I think, you know, we're just going to keep floundering.
That's
Thank
you. I really appreciate it. Let me respond to you and then also call on Heidi. What's clear, and I know you know this, but what's clear is that the brain of the addict is completely hijacked. Every major system is hijacked by addiction. I think I'm fully in agreement with what's at least implied, if not out and out stated, in what you just shared with us, is that for me, the work that I've done the last 2 years primarily about reducing shame and stigma within the profession, the mental health profession, as well as to the lay public, has been what I've done is leveraged information from the neurosciences. And it's coming right out of my personal experience, is that it was as if the heavens opened for me to really begin to understand the science behind addiction as a means for reducing my own shame and my own sense of self-stigmatization. And so it's not out of some kind of theory or textbook for me. It's out of personal experience. I was in a hospital in a detox unit, and the most helpful things to me were the lectures by the psychiatrist about what was going on in my brain. It was like it finally gave me a toehold whereby I could begin to look seriously at sobriety and the work that was going to be required in recovery. Because of the claim that stigma and shame internalized for myself, because of the claim they had on me, I wasn't going to be able to turn the corner to move into recovery unless I went through or around that, and I didn't find anything that was as effective for me. I've since utilized this in the recovery coaching that I do, and I've never had a client respond any other way than with gratitude for any information about what goes in the brain in and around addiction. I share it with families. I share it with the individuals who themselves are in recovery. And I really agree with you that needs to happen. If there's two things that I'm really, really committed to, and it's totally evident here. One is what we just talked about, is really bringing in an understanding, a compassionate, really, but also, kind of hardline neuroscientific understanding of what goes on in addiction, just to begin to destigmatize all of the moralism that goes on around addiction. And then secondly, to bring in the systemic aspects of addiction, that is, namely, we've got to begin to address the lower left-hand quadrant more consciously. And with advances in the last 100 years since Al-Anon started, there's just that we have too many resources in multiple fields, from marriage and family therapy to sociology to cultural anthropology to psychology, et cetera, to not really be actively integrating that material into the day-to-day. And God willing, over time, there might be an increasing or continued cultural shift. But I'm really committed to that. And I think that's one of the brilliant things about integral recovery, is it's a map that at last might be sufficient to bring in enough of the diversity, or let's call it the quadrants, so that we can address this disease in something other than a kind of one-size-fits-all approach. So that's my story, and I stand by it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Heidi, I wanted to call on you, too, and then we'll move on. But I also want to check in with you if you have any reflections.
Oh, thank you, but I'm happy to just listen.
Okay. What I want to suggest, and Lisa, this is in direct response to you, is that I'd like to delegate a separate presentation, maybe down the line, because I think it's important to really going into, in a way that's accessible, going into addiction and the brain, and what does a diseased brain look like in regards to addiction, and what does a recovered or recovering on the way to health brain look like. And I'd like to do that in the way that I do it with my clients. I don't want to talk so technically that it's not understandable to me or anybody else. But I've done a fair bit of reflection on this, and most of you have probably done your own share of reading, but I'd love to create a dialogue in and around addiction. And just to give you a sense of it, it's my way of understanding post-acute withdrawal syndrome, or what's the acronym for that is PAWS, P-A-W-S. And in terms of the earliest, this kind of stage one recovery that Nixon refers to, it represents typically it's seen as between 6 months to 2 years, where the brain is of an addict is in recovery. And the length of that recovery depends on so many variables, the duration of the addiction, the intensity in terms of the various substances and the amounts used, as well as just the uniqueness of each one of our brains and bodies. It's just very, very individual. So there's no set number of weeks, months, or even years. It's just that in this earliest stage one recovery, the brain continues to be really hamstrung. And the way I would talk about it it would be another conversation at the very least, probably a few. I'd like to talk about it in terms of the impact on the dopamine system, which have to do with our assigning importance to things as well as our motivation. I'd like to look at this PAWS, or post-addiction withdrawal syndrome, in terms of how it manifests in the opioid system, which is our system that manages pain relief, as well as is integrally connected to our attachment, our connection to others. A third system I'd like to talk about would be the self-regulation system in the brain, which assigns which stamps in memory, particularly around triggers and so on, as well as is instrumental in impulse control, which is when there's no capacity to contain impulses, particularly aggression. You can imagine how it goes sideways in a relationship, and we'll talk about that more as we go on. But I'd like to talk about that system that manages the impulse control, which is the self-regulation system. And then fourthly, I'd like to go into talking about the stress system, which is instrumental in our processing trauma, as well as rebalancing the body in and around addiction. So you've got four brain systems at least, each of which is associated with two really important behaviors for managing ourselves, so eight different behaviors. So if we could learn four systems and eight behaviors, which I think is learnable, that'd be a stride in the right direction, so that we could talk to somebody with some sense of increasing comfort about what goes haywire in the brain, and maybe more pertinent to what we're talking about today, to be able to introduce this to the spouse or the partner so that they can have good, solid brain information about what's going on with their seemingly crazy addict partner in recovery. And this gets to your point, I think, earlier, Victoria, which would be, what would it be like for counselors to be trained and be poised to just share some good biology, share some good information, foundational information that could help the spouse or the partner to understand that there's a disease process that's in the process of healing. It's going to take months, sometimes a couple of years even, and to provide other resources during that time, as well as what not to expect, or what not to feel needs to be happening. What in Colleen's experience, and she'll talk more about this next week, couples will come in, their spouse is early in recovery, and they want to get to work right away on, let's work out all of the, I need to have a place where I can talk about the betrayals in our relationship, and I want my addicted spouse in recovery to be responsive. And what's clear from the research on PAWS, post-acute withdrawal syndrome, and what's also clear in terms of its relationship to these various brain systems and behaviors I just mentioned, is that the brain of the addicted individual in recovery is nowhere yet ready to, at a biological level, nowhere yet ready to do any in-depth relational repair. There's not enough traction there. There's an incapacity, relatively speaking, in PAWS to self-reflect. What you have instead is a kind of reactivity. It's very difficult for the individual still in PAWS, in and out of the ups and downs of what's going on in the brain. Very difficult for any kind of sustained empathy. Oftentimes there's much more defensiveness or I need to win. You know, it's back to that kind of impulse control. And there's a major problem in PAWS. It's very difficult for the addict in recovery to experience, and I know this firsthand, to experience self-forgiveness. And instead what's in its place is a huge amount of, as you might imagine, shame, or as psychology likes to call it, self-stigmatization. And so you can imagine what it's like if you're buried by shame to have a partner coming at you, pissed off, in search of healing, and what they're bringing is overwhelmingly shameful. And so I can't forgive myself, and now you can't forgive me either. And so there you get one of the massive, the biggest triggers for relapse, is it's so incredibly stressful. If you're suffocating in your own shame, how can you possibly bear the shame that's coming from the person that matters most to you on the planet? So all of these competencies I just named are vital for repairing what goes on in a relationship, but they all require an intact, well-recovered brain, and that really isn't until stage two, once somebody has moved through as much as possible the worst of that post-acute withdrawal phase. And so a mistake that many marriage and family therapists make is they'll start working with people too early in the process on relational repair, and one of the people they're working with does not have the capacity to do that level of work. The therapy spirals downward, it fails, and in many ways it's a function of having tried to do something that's the right thing, but at the wrong time. It's premature. So let me pause there for a second, and then we'll continue on. But let me check in with you guys. How does that land?
It's Lisa. I just wanted to ask a question, especially of you and Victoria, because I really have empathy for the hell we put our partners through. It's just, oh, my God, it's ridiculous.
It is ridiculous.
Yeah, and I totally actually understand their feeling. Why should I go to a 12-step group when you've got the problem? But it just seems to me like there's another way that you're talking about. And it occurred to me when my husband stopped seeing it so personally, not to let me off the hook, let him off the hook.
Very good. Very good, Lisa. That's great.
Mean to say help the spouse see it as not something personal to them so that the addict can feel good about themselves. I think that's, I agree that the shame thing is a killer, and I'm not a big fan of shame-based interventions or any of that. But I'm trying to put myself in the partner's position, and I know when I realize what somebody's doing isn't personal, it helps me a lot. Not to deny my feelings about it, but it's helpful. So maybe that's sort of a benefit.
Thanks.
Like get them the help they need psychologically, directly, without couples. I wasn't ready to do couple stuff either. No way.
No. Let me respond. I really appreciate what you're saying, and it feels just chock full of insight, Lisa. is that, you know, just as the addict, if they're serious about their recovery, is going to have a program puts the rubber on the road, basically. So working through 12-step process, intensive psychotherapy, meditation, mindfulness practice, certainly being an active partner, actively involved in a recovery community, all of that is pretty much standard fare. And to go with what you're suggesting, is I think really, really sensitively, is that what spouse or what partner is gonna be able to keep clear that my going into Al-Anon or any other resource is somehow like, am I now to blame for this? I didn't sign on for this. After all, he or she's the addict, not me. And so I think the importance of this is to provide a rationale for it that is clearly not about blaming that partner, but about providing a resource for that partner. So in addition to Al-Anon, which is typically where it kind of starts and then where it stops, I think that it would be really important, whatever form it is, to recovery coaching, chemical dependency counselor, integral recovery coach, whatever it would be, is I think it's really important to educate both members, but including the spouse, educate them in the neurobiology of addiction. That is, here's what's going on in the brain of your spouse. Here's what was going on while they were addicted. Here's what's going on even yet. And to provide some kind of group support that can process that level, process what you just suggested, which would be any kind of residual shame for the partner, process the reactions, and I would say even the grief over realizing that this is, if I'm going to stay with my husband or wife, my boyfriend, my girlfriend, my partner, it's going to require months, years, and in many ways a lifetime of recovery. And to be able to have a place to express that with people who might be able to kind of share their shoulders and cry upon that. The spouse, the partner who's in recovery oftentimes is so vulnerable, there's just no bandwidth for that level of work. And so why not provide a group, and I'm thinking in addition to Al-Anon, a process group that's led by a skill facilitator that encourages the expression of that level of emotion, for example, grief, as well as provides really solid psychoeducation in and around the physiology, the brain and addiction. Because I think the key here, and is also implied in what you were saying, Lisa, the key is, can you help the couple in stage one, this you can do, can you help the couple to come together in terms of identifying or even externalizing this problem? That the addiction or the disease is the problem that we're both together fighting, rather than my partner is the crazy person that continues to be crazy, and that says something bad about me, what's wrong with me that I have a crazy partner, and all the other ways that can go sideways. If there's any way to help a couple by providing information, by providing processes for each one of them individually, and you can even come together with a couple, as long as you're clear about, there's a distinction that's made in the marriage and family therapy between a centralizing engagement and a facilitating engagement. And a centralizing engagement is where the therapist has the couple respond to him or her directly. And you can kind of adjust the temperature on what's going on in the consulting room by having individuals in the couple speak to the therapist. As soon as you do what's called a facilitating engagement, that is, have them begin talking to each other, guess what? That's where the heat comes up. And sometimes you want that to come out. I would advise, based on what we're talking about, to use very little of that, though, in the early stages, because you have a very fragile alliance at best, and it doesn't need more heat yet, because there's not enough myelin sheath, there's not enough insulation in the relationship to be able to handle that much heat. So you can have a couple come in, but have them talk to you as the therapist and provide an empathic response to each partner so that they can begin to have modeled what may be possible down the line. If that works, if that doesn't work, then you see them individually and you work on each one of them. But I think providing a backdrop that includes not only what happens in the brain and around addiction and around the healing of it, but also the impact that has on relationship, around, for example, adjusting expectations in the relationship, understanding why it's going to be very difficult for a good period of time to have the kinds of conversations that they ultimately might want to have in terms of repairing ruptures, healing the brokenness, the despair, that's going to have to wait. That's a start in the right direction of moving. What you're wanting to do is move through this stage one with as much ambition as possible, but also sensitive to the realistic limitations, so that the stage two work, which is really what we'll be talking more about next week, where you're actually beginning to open the hood and get in and dig into the engine of the relationship, when that's ready, you've established the foundation. So I'm even thinking of any couples counseling that happens in this first stage should be referred to as, or at least understood as being foundational couple counseling. This is not more intense, in-depth relational repair work. It's really not wise to do that. In fact, it's iatrogenic. It'll make the couple sicker. If you begin digging in prematurely when there's not a capacity to contain it, they'll blow apart very predictably. It happens all the time. It happens all the time, which is a sadness. That's a lot of information, you guys. Let me check in with you. We'll wind down. So I just want to kind of check in with you to see if kind of what we've talked about, and that was mainly in response to you, Lisa, if that makes some sense, if you have questions, if we can clarify things. This is all stage one we're talking about.
Well, I will respond. It's fascinating how much all of this is bringing back for me that I haven't thought about for a very long time. But
good.
I was just at the middle of an internship to become a therapist when this occurred in my life.
Wow.
And, to respond to my response to it, Lisa, was not, why do I have to do this? But it was, I'm totally willing to do whatever it takes. But the shock of having a partner who just was not able to move forward in any way with the recovery. And over the years, as I've reflected upon that, because we divorced, I don't know, several years after that, what I've always seen is that he had underlying issues like childhood sexual abuse and those kinds of things that he never did address. And so my suspicion was that whatever was going on at a deeper level was too painful for him to experience. But I'm seeing this in such a different light because at that time in treatment, there was very little for the families, and that's what I picked up on and began to do groups for the families.
Good for you.
Because, it just wasn't in existence at that time. But this, what you're speaking of now, I can just imagine if I had had this kind of information, plus if he had had that, there's the potential for a much different outcome from what we experienced.
Yeah. Thank you, Victoria. I can only imagine, the pain that you went through and the loss that represented. And I feel such compassion for you. And I Colleen and I talk about this even in our relationship, in our own respective histories in marriages from which we were divorced, is that there just wasn't the information that we're talking about today, for example, in terms of the neuroscience of addiction, just as one example. Most of this research has been done in the last 10 years because it's only in the last 10 years that there's been sufficient technology to research it out. It's really a function of history kind of gradually edging forward. And so brain scan technology has been available basically and utilized in studying this only in the last 10 years. And so you and I are out of luck historically in terms of what was even available. I started graduate school 35 years ago with a professor who was a neuropsychologist. He was my advisor. He had just come back from Russia studying under Luria, the premier brain scientist on the planet. And at that point, I can remember the very first lectures is that the assumption was is that the brain cannot repair or change itself after about age 25. Well, that's
exactly.
Been completely reversed. I mean, just like, and it's not that long ago, and yet it's eons ago, but you and I didn't have access to that information. And then secondly, what's happened in the last 10 to 20 years in terms of therapeutic technology in terms of things that can be done that are rooted in science that are effective. None of that I learned in graduate school. None of that I taught. I mean, I taught these courses in graduate school without this information being available. So it's all really recent. So our kids and their kids have the benefit of this as long as we are responsible in getting this information out there. And frankly, we just didn't have it at our disposal. If I have a passion, and I know Lisa knows this, is that with all due respect, and I have a tremendous amount of respect for the 12-step programs, that without the integration of this information, I feel like that they're hamstrung by information that is rooted 75 going on 100 years ago, that a lot of it's valuable. But to ignore the strides that have been made just in these two domains that we've been talking about, in brain science and in relationship science, I feel like is a, well, that's what we're here about at Integral, is to try to fill out the picture with this kind of stuff and then to get the word out there. And so that people would be trained and that this would become the norm. And society's going to shift very slowly, as we all know around this. But these kinds of conversations and then how these ripple out to other conversations that all of us have, they're instrumental in that kind of change happening culturally. And so, I grieve with you what we didn't know 20 and 30 years ago, Victoria, for sure.
Well, yeah. But it's kept us committed to finding out. That's the other part of it.
Yes, yes. It's the little grain of sand inside the shell that's, maybe there's a pearl being created. It has definitely kept us motivated. Yeah, no, I know that for all of us here, that this work comes out of personal experience, firsthand or at least secondhand, that there's a passion that drives it. And it's out of questions that weren't being answered, about suffering that was not being addressed. And so, that is a good way to look at it, and that is actually the way I look at it in terms of my own suffering and the suffering I've caused to others. Is if I can somehow convert that alchemically into gold with the help of the universe, then it's worth it.
Right, exactly. And I let it go for a number of years just out of frustration because I didn't see a place that it was moving. And so to come back to it at this stage and see how much has happened is very encouraging.
Yeah, I'm right with you, right here.
I have a quick question for you, Bob.
Sure.
Do you have particular books that you recommend on attachment theory?
Yeah, I do. I've read a number of books on it, and some of them are very good and much more technical. So yeah, I'll give you a couple of examples. I think a really good book that's just come out is Sue Johnson's latest book, and this is a book that anybody can read, including a client that's willing to read, and it's just called Love Sense. Love Sense, S-E-N-S-E, and in it, and she includes she situates marriage and family therapy within an attachment theory backdrop, and does a really good job of giving you kind of an introduction to attachment theory, including tracing it back to its origins in the work of John Bowlby in England and how it's moved forward. That's a more non-technical book on it. For a more technical book, the best book I know is by David Wallin, W-A-L-L-I-N, David Wallin. He's up at Berkeley, and he has a book called Attachment in Psychotherapy. That to me is a masterpiece. It's just, it's very much more understandable. If you've ever read any of the attachment theorists or researchers in their own language, it's like any literature. It's a very technical language. He does a really good job of translating it, and that's not a book that necessarily a layperson would read, but owing to your own background, you might find that really appealing. He's a wonderful teacher, too. I've heard him speak and teach this material. He's really got a teacher's heart, and so he's able to take very technical material and translate it into a language that is understandable. So those are two good books. Love Sense, to start off in a more popular, accessible thing, for the written really for the layperson, and does a good job of introducing it. And then for the next level, I'd recommend Wallin's book. How does that sound?
Thanks so much. That's great.
Yeah,
thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah. They're both available in Kindle and ebook formats. I tend to read nowadays on my iPad, and so if that's any advantage, and you can get them in paperback too, so whatever form.
Great. Okay.
Let me check in with Lisa and Heidi before we wrap up. We're winding down now. at the any final kind of comments or questions that you all might have.
Yeah, it's Lisa. Just one comment. One, just gratitude to you and Victoria that you aren't willing to settle for the status quo. We need you in this field desperately.
Right on. Right on, Lisa.
And I want you guys to know how much that means to me as an addict who also, you know, sees other addicts suffering.
Yes.
And I will say this on the neuropsychology front, I think is the most exciting thing happening. And when I started reading about it and started reading about how my reptilian brain was hijacking my thinking process and basically put my neocortex on hold, that no wonder my cravings felt like life or death. I was operating from a life or death piece of my brain.
Yeah.
And it was involuntary in that, you know, once I ingested the drugs, that's what got lit up. Boy, that really helped me a lot get excited about recovery. It helped me a lot to get excited about the whole field and the possibility when we understand really what they're starting to discover in that area. And, I think it's really great to have the spouses and family members understand that, and I also understand they need a place to vent just years of frustration and rage that's so understandable before they, you know, even dive into that. That they have a place to just go, I hate this motherfucker, you know, part of my
bitch.
But that part just gets a voice, my God.
Yeah, I want to respond real quickly as we wind down, Lisa, to what you said. I'm right with you. I mean, I absolutely share the same experience around this. In psychology, there's what's referred to as the fundamental attribution error, and you'll get this in a second, and it really is, we can relate it to exactly this conversation, is that with fundamental attribution error, what I do, if I'm the addict in recovery, is I attribute my addiction to something flawed in my character. And I don't want to mix this up with AA language because it's not meant as a slam at AA. It's just I'll attribute my addiction to something fundamentally wrong in my character. And if anybody else has a problem, I'll attribute that to their circumstance or their situation. Whereas what happens is that with this reversal, as you begin to get acquainted, in this case, talking about just fundamental scientific language about what goes on in the brain in and around addiction, is that you begin to, for the first time, to be able to externalize this addiction as a disease process that is a situation that anybody in my circumstance that got their brain going down this particular line or this particular road, they're going to end up in the same fix, and so it gets harder and harder to attribute it to something fundamentally wrong with your character. In fact, what happens in one's character in terms of moral decision-making and so on is so rerouted or hijacked or commandeered by the addiction is that it's the addiction itself that becomes the situation that's the problem. If you can get an individual, whether it's you or me, Lisa, and or our respective, you know, families, significant others, and so on, once you can get somebody to get that kind of paradigm shift of moving from attributing something, you know, my husband, my wife is the devil, to move from that to realizing, this is what addiction does, very predictably. You can understand the research, and if it's simply explained, it's very understandable. And that you're right, that if we're not able to stop the addiction, this behavior will continue. But this is no statement on the fundamental character or disposition of the addict as much as it is a comment on what happens biochemically. And that this definitely does affect the neocortex, does affect thinking, does affect judgment and planning and problem solving. But that's the problem. And if you can get a couple to buy into that, to really invest in that, then you're ready to move into stage two work. And that's really where we'll move next week. So this first stage is about acknowledging what's at hand, still active in the brain of the addict in recovery, and helping the couple, helping each individual, but helping the couple especially to begin to talk about the problem as something other than their partner. The example I've given is the couple that comes in and the husband looks at me and says, my wife is the problem without which I would be perfectly happy. Everything else is wonderful in my life. If you can help a couple to move beyond that kind of demonizing of one another, and Victoria, you pointed at this, and Lisa, you did too, it's very hard it's very hard to get to that position when you've been wounded and trust has been absolutely stomped into the test. But if you can get the couple to move beyond that attribution to beginning to now begin to look at the disease process as something that we're going to, that we're going to fight this together, well, you're over half the battle is won. And that the next piece is the significant healing that can happen in stage two. So, why don't we leave it at there for today, and we'll plan next week to pick up with that, and my partner Colleen will be here, and I'm looking forward to her meeting all of you. How's that sound?
Are you doing Friday?
Yes, I'll be on here on Friday, absolutely. So we'll follow up on this more on Friday. Victoria, I hope you can join us too, okay?
Yes, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Victoria. This is really
exciting.
Thank you for sharing.
Yeah, really appreciate it. Thanks, Lisa. Thanks to Mary and Heidi for getting us here together, okay?
You bet.
All right. See you guys on Friday.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye for now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.